From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today, a view of our elections and of Iowa through the eyes of writers from abroad. Established writers from around the world will tell us how they experienced the U.S. elections, how our elections differ from theirs, and about life in Iowa compared to their countries. Over 30 foreign writers have spent the last 10 weeks in residency as part of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. We'll be joined this hour by Gada Abdul-Al from Egypt, Billy Kahara from Kenya, and Pola Ola Kaharik from Argentina. U.S. elections and life in Iowa, a view from abroad after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a view of our elections and Iowa through the eyes of writers from abroad. Over 38 foreign writers have just spent the last 10 weeks in residency as part of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. They've been working on their writing, participating in panel discussions and in other public events, and just generally soaking up Midwestern culture. We've invited three of them to be with us this hour. We have with us Gada Abdul-Al from Egypt, a fiction writer and a screenwriter. Welcome to you.
Oh, hi, Ben. Welcome. Thank you.
And Billy Kuhora from Kenya. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Ben. It's lovely being here.
And Pola Aloy Sharak from Argentina. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for having us.
Let's talk, if we could. We have a lot of your experiences to share, and we would love to get the phone out to our listeners, too, if you have a question for one of our international writers, 1-866-780-9100, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Let's begin by talking about elections. You had the unique opportunity of being in a foreign country, this country being foreign to you, and being able to observe the election campaign here. Perhaps you had little interest, a lot of interest, I don't know, in the way we do politics and electioneering in this country. Let me just throw it out to you. What stood out for you about our election campaign compared to the campaigns run in your country? Who wants to start? Billy.
I kept on catching these ads, the local politicians, and I was just amazed. And I felt there was a kind of defamatory element to them, in the sense that you'd have a guy come up and say, a voice that would actually go on and say, oh, this guy doesn't care about daycare center, he's raised taxes on medicines or things like that. And this just was just on and on and on. I think just the week before, that kind of blew me away. The other thing I followed was John Stewart, Colbert, that whole rally in Washington, D.C. I found that very, very interesting.
Wait, for what reason?
I just think, first, what was it called? Raising fear and insanity, and just having this huge, huge audience just caught up with this. And the questions are, then the questions that followed after that were, what's their purpose? Are they running for public office? What are they doing? I couldn't really just get it. I like the music, though. between the political messages, I kind of like the music. I've been asked a lot by people because of Obama, what happens now? Mm-hmm. Is this a sign of things to come in the re-elections and what that means? And people, I think, expect me to kind of say something because I'm Kenyan and
exactly,
he has that kind of connection. But I, like, generally, I consider him more American than anything else. It's amazing that he had a Kenyan father, but this is an American issue for me.
Mm-hmm. How is he viewed in Kenya?
They're different. They're different kind of. I think there are three main kind of like aspects to the Obama figure in Kenya. There's a claim by some politicians, especially a lot of ethnic conversations, because he's Luo, and there's a huge kind of Luo push, Luo presence in national elections. So it's a big one, and they kind of claim him. And then, of course, the others, because he came to Kenya while he was a senator, and it was interesting how the opposition claimed him and what the government actually did and the things they did. There's an amazing thing about, just like everyone else in the world, this is a black man of an incredible intelligence, political savvy. You read his book and you're like, wow.
He's handsome. So
Yeah. He gives everyone around the world who's young just like, this is actually possible. So that's an amazing way. The third one is really, the debate America, Kenya, because when he came to Africa, he didn't actually come to Kenya. He was in Egypt, right?
Yeah, he was.
Ghana, I think. I can't remember where they went to South Africa, but he didn't come to Kenya, which was quite interesting. So those are the three main things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Paula and Gada, what comes to mind when we talk about politics here versus in Egypt? In Egypt, President Mubarak has ruled the country for nearly 30 years, and the presidents are elected in Egypt as a single party candidate, aren't they?
Yeah.
So you don't have these sort of attack ads there as well.
Well, we don't. I mean, sometimes I think we're lucky that we don't, because when I was watching some ads here, that was very scary. I mean, the thing that people are allowed to be racist while they are running for public positions. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I mean, I was for a short time in Texas, and I watched an ad on the television calling all the Mexican people gang members. And that was like, how can anyone get away with that? And why can't anyone like raise their voice and say that this is wrong? I mean, you can't be racist against some people in America. You can't be racist against black people in public or homosexuals. But it's okay to be racist against Mexicans and Muslims now. So that was really amazing for me. And the whole xenophobia thing that's really, you know, with the Tea Party and Republicans and Fox News, and that was actually very scary and very disappointing.
So the view you get of Americans toward the outside world is what? Viewing our elections.
But I remember one thing. I remember, Gada, on September 11 that you wanted to go to the rodeo, and it was just very strange situation, because
September 11th of this year.
Yeah, of this year.
On the 9/11 anniversary. So you went to a rodeo in Iowa or somewhere else?
Well, all the writers were invited to go to a rodeo, but, you know, I found out that everyone is invited except me, because I'm a Muslim and I wear a veil, and everyone said, well, it might not be a good idea to go, because there might be some people who are not that open-minded, and we're afraid about your safety, which
really
was very shocking. You know, it was like the first or the second week here in Iowa, and I was like, my safety? And it really rang a bell, and it was very horrifying. And it was also the 2 weeks of let's burn the Quran.
You experienced
period.
That whole episode, the threat of the Quran burning by the Florida pastor there as well. So you, as a Muslim, a Muslim woman, you wear a headscarf, you notice you are treated much differently than in your homeland of Egypt.
Of course. I mean, for one thing, all the channels on the television was either talking about Islam or about vampires, which was, you know, if you put them together, it was very scary. And the rodeo thing, it was the first time it wasn't the first time, but it was one of the times that I really felt like I'm discriminated against.
Mm.
But then you went to the rodeo.
Well, I went to the rodeo, but I'm in some kind of disguise, because I tied my veil to the back, and I had like a baseball cap, and nothing really happened. Well, a guy
she
looked
was
at
dressed
me
like a redneck.
Yeah. Well, I was trying.
Xenophobia.
Yeah. Well, a guy looked at me and rolled his eyes and said like, "Oh dear God," something like that. But other than that, you know, I was safe, but...
Mm-hmm. How do people interpret headscarves here in the United States? What misconceptions do you see people looking at you with?
Well, actually, I don't think that people know anything about headscarf here. And that's why when I always meet anyone, I just say, Google a little. I mean, just find out. I mean, yeah.
Give us a little education about why Muslim women wear headscarves, or the different type of headscarves.
Okay, maybe I can speak in the voice of all Muslim women. I can say why I wear the hijab, for example, or even try to explain the idea or the fact that sometimes women want to wear a hijab. We're not obligated to wear it. We're not forced to wear it. We're not oppressed. And I remember, like the first week I was here, one of our colleague Maria from Belarus, she said, "I don't understand how can a smart woman put this thing on her head, something like that." Mm-hmm. And that was very shocking. And I said, "Well, I don't ask you why do you wear this skirt and not a longer skirt. So I don't comment on your on the way you wear your clothes. Why should you wear comment on the way that, you know, I'm dressed?"
Interesting. Interesting. Mm-hmm. With us joining, if you just joined us this hour, Ghada Abdul Al from Egypt is with us. All writers visiting Iowa over the last 10 weeks, and they are finishing up their stay here. Also Billy Kuhora from Kenya and Paula Oloy Sharak from Argentina. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Reading your blog, Paula, I see that you all had some fun with Halloween. You were here during the Halloween time. Paula, reading your blog, I see that because you have a likeness of Sarah Palin, that you were thinking of dressing up as Sarah Palin.
Well, I just wanted to profit the fact that I was here and that, you know, some people call the attention on my uncanny resemblance to Mrs. Sarah Louise Palin. And I remember seeing these rallies during the election with Obama when she would, I think it was a little bit before the people were holding things with the hockey moms, etc. And so she was, you know, carrying like this little baby who was her son. I mean, I'm sorry, her grandson, little baby Trig. Then I found out. And so I thought that it would be like a nice outfit for me to dress in her likeness. But also I needed, you know, this prop, you know, like this little baby with Down syndrome. But I couldn't find one here in Iowa. And so, well, one of the writers considered maybe one of the other writers should be, you know, play my son. But I asked him if he wanted to play my son, and he wasn't really game for it. I don't, maybe he, you know, he wasn't really interested in the GOP and confirmation and maybe the future of the coming up minority. So it kind of ended there.
What other Halloween stories did you have? Did you have a costume as well?
Oh, I did. I dressed in the second scariest thing in America because I think that Sarah Palin the first scared thing in America. So I was dressed as Guantanamo Bay detainee. So
and I wanted to be dressed like a military man, but then I couldn't find anything that could, you know.
Yeah,
that
we wanted
fit.
To go, yeah, as a couple.
And we wanted to go as a couple, you know. But then, I mean, at the party you found a sergeant.
Yeah, we went to a party and I found a guy who was dressed as a surgeon. So
in
we
Iraq.
Had, you know, an interesting Abu Ghraib.
Abu Ghraib, yeah.
You're laughing about it, but it makes me uneasy that we're laughing about these things. Does it make you uneasy? Easy as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, before I choose to dress this way, I asked some people, I mean, when you dress in something in Halloween, like we met this guy who dresses like Jesus. So does that mean that you're mocking the person or that you're like identifying with him or
honoring him?
Or honoring him.
Honoring him?
So my idea was like I'm trying to make everyone not forget about them. Well, it was, I mean, there is still Guantanamo Bay and no one actually paid for anything that he did in Guantanamo Bay or in Abu Ghraib, and Obama had this strange for not to go after anyone who's responsible for these incidents of torture and stuff. So I think that my idea was just like for other people to remember, well, this is an issue that still didn't have a conclusion.
You were all young writers. I wanted to shift gears here and talk about, of course, here we have generational changes in every country, and this is perhaps something that cuts across all cultures. I know, Ghada, you write about this in your blog, in your book, let's take that as an example. You have a blog called Wanna Be a Bride, blogspot.com. Your book, translated into many languages, I Want to Get Married. That's a satirical novel that's been translated also into English. Actually, also turned into a TV series in Arabic. And I think we have a little bit of the sound from that. perhaps let's listen to it and you can tell us what's going on. This is from, is the TV series called also called I Want to Get Married?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And this is in Egypt right now.
Yes.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of it.
المشكلة الأساسية إن كل شخص بيتوسط في جوازة بيعتبرها إهانة شخصية جدا لو الجوازة دي ما تمتش
حضرتك مرتبطة
ويوم بعد يوم الفرص بتقل ما تحرجنيش أكتر من كده بقى لو سمحت كل واحد أو واحدة بيتقمصوا وبيقطعونا
أهلا وسهلا فندم عطفيني قبل دهو
في الآخر برضو لو ما اتجوزتش هيقولوا خايبة بايرة فاشلة وفاتها القطر
Okay, that's from the TV series I Want to Get Married, an Egyptian series based on the work of Gada Abdul Al. So tell us what was going on in that specific piece.
Well,
the non-Arabic speakers out there.
Yeah, it was the trailer, and the girl was talking about the fact that everyone who whoever fixed you the suitor, which is some kind of a it's like a blind date, and if you said no, actually I don't like him, then he will just cut all his connections with you and he will not talk to you again. Then you'd more than one suitor coming to her house, her family house, and how strange they are. And you can listen to one of them who is a police officer, which is like a big authority in Egypt. People actually are scared of police officers. And so once he entered her house, her family house, he just shouts at everyone, and her father is actually very scared of him.
Mm. In looking at it and not understanding Arabic, but just looking at it, it's a very, very professionally done TV series. But in looking at this young girl, attractive woman growing up in Egypt, I assume, facing the challenges of her family's expectations of traditions, this is something that cuts across all cultures here. So it's very similar. It ties us together. Paula, observations, you've gotten to know Gada here, observations about this topic, the younger generation in Argentina versus the older generation, those kind of cross or intergenerational controversies, conflicts. What's going on in Argentina?
Well, recently there was Néstor Kirchner, who was the ex-president of Argentina, died. And that elicited, a number of demonstrations from young people who felt that they were sort of represented by this government. And well, now it's his wife who is in power. I follow very little of the of it. I was anyway. I thought it was interesting that so many people were kind of like so happy that he died to the point of celebrating it with champagne and other people. Mostly young people were kind of exhilarated about it. I tend to believe that both positions were kind of exaggerated, mm-hmm. By the stories we're telling them.
Let me ask, what are younger people most concerned about in Argentina? What's on their minds?
Well, they have third world concerns such as finding jobs and trying to, you know, to follow their passions while at the same time having a dignified life. And I would say that a lot of people are also concerned about there are a lot of people starving in the north of the country. However, this government, though, you know, it's supposedly very liberally connected to good causes, has not done anything relevant on that matter. The politics is much more of a certain paternalism that, you know, that keeps the joke in control, you know, the power. I think most people just want to study and you know have a decent and beautiful life, just like in every other.
Billy Kuhora, in Kenya, the concerns of the younger, older generations, concerns, how do they differ with those you see around yourself here in the United States?
In 2007, we had elections, and once the presidential election results were announced, there was a disagreement. The opposition and half the country almost disagreed with these results. And what immediately happened was 3 months of killing, looting, and burning. the majority of the people who are doing the young people. Kenya has a population of roughly 40 million now. 80% of that population is under 32. When you look at the economics, about 10 to 15% of the population own 80% of the country. And of course, these are older people. So the connection between those statistics is that younger people are increasingly, of course, disenfranchised. They're the huge part of the poor and all those things. And like Paula said, they just want decent, dignified lives. They want to get a strong education where you actually get a job. So employment is a huge issue. And then of course that results in many things like crime. It results in all sorts of kind of social breakdowns.
How does that figure into your writing, Billy?
I put on two hats almost always. I'm a creative nonfiction writer, I'm a fiction writer, and I'm an editor of something called Kwani, which is an anthology. And we're going to release an issue that's from writers who were born under 1978. That is important in Kenya because that was when the second president of Kenya that led on to become what is considered a despot, a dictator, ruled for 24 years. And there was a lot of euphoria in 2003 when he left. So we are, as an editor, I'm very, very interested in the voice of the younger people. My own work is about, the novel I'm working for on is about a family that's struggling in the 1990s with the socioeconomic breakdown that happened at the time. And there are different points of view between the matriarch who decides just to go nuts just to survive. There's the three kids. They're all very different, but I'm very, very interested in getting their point of view across. They're of different ages, so they're slightly different generations. And it's just their lives, whether it's politics, whether it's the day-to-day, whether it's alcoholism, whether it's madness, whether it's just hustling. Because mm-hmm. Kenya's a hustle. If you're young, you're hustling. That's what it is.
We have to take a break in about a minute, but did you all find time in the 10 weeks to write here, or was there just so much going on to do that big smiles all around that you didn't have time to work on your writing? It's called a residency, right?
Well, it's called the residency, but it was too many events.
You had a lot of events.
Yeah, we did.
And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about that. I want you to think of the events that come to mind, because I want to ask you about your experiences here in Iowa that you will take with you on in your further writing career. Perhaps it will enter some inspiration, or an actual experience will enter your writing in the future. Perhaps it'll be just something that you remember about Iowa forevermore. Joining us this hour, international writers. There have been 38 foreign writers from 30 different countries the last 10 weeks at the University of Iowa's International Writing Program as part of the residency. Joining us today, three of them. We couldn't get 38 in the studio. We have Gada Abdul Al from Egypt, Billy Kuhura from Kenya, and Paula Aloy Sharak from Argentina. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. More conversation with international writers when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, a view of our elections and Iowa through the eyes of writers from abroad. We have had 38 foreign writers from 30 different countries spending the last 10 weeks in a residency as part of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. They've been working on writing, participating in panel discussions, other public events, soaking up culture here in the Midwest. And we have three of those 38 writers here as they prepare to depart Iowa and the United States to go back to their countries. Gada Abdul Al is with us from Egypt, a fiction writer, a screenwriter. And we also have a fiction writer and a nonfiction writer, Billy Kuhura from Kenya, and Paula Aloy Sharak from Argentina. And we want to talk a little bit more about the experiences that they had over these 10 weeks. As promised before the break, you're all writers. your antenna are up, I assume, more or less all the time, observing surroundings, interactions with people. Billy, what will you take home with you to Kenya or perhaps bring into your writing that you experienced here in Iowa?
I think in a very interesting way, I see Iowa, my experiences here, as a kind of blank, calm slate that I can write. I have a quite a frenetic life before I got here. I was extremely exhausted, both I think emotionally, mentally, and the first 2 weeks for me were just rest and just calmness. And then I had quite a schedule where I was traveling all over the place, and I came to see this place as it became home in very many ways. I wanted to come back. When you spend a lot of time in airports, it gets really weary.
It was nice to be somewhere for 10 weeks, yeah. not move around too much.
Yeah.
If you think about coming back, and we yeah. certainly hope you will in years to come, what yeah. were some of your favorite things to do? What would you first seek out?
I come from a place where I think first and foremost, you can't even say enough about just being here with 30 other people, and everybody, you can have a literary or political conversation at any given time. I come from a place where people are just trying to survive, so they don't have time for this conversation, so that's amazing. Going for the readings, talking to people about different things, some of the stuff IW set up, it's a huge, huge learning curve, whether it's seeing professionals read and learning stuff, whether it's learning about, I'm very curious about places like Argentina, so I'll ask, one of the first things I asked Paula, like when I met her, we talked slightly about Borges. I'm just very curious about the space because it also makes me learn about my place. I mean, I'm curious about Egypt. Egypt's not very, very, very far away from Kenya. It's not even that expensive to go there. So it's good. I meet Gada because if I head there in the next 3 years, she's there. You know, you can't the value, just the sheer value in that. Just as a writer, the literary conversations, that was amazing. Io as a citizen. Just a calmness, man. Like, I feel my batteries are completely recharged going back into heavy, heavy work. And that's a big thing for me.
Mm-hmm. And you experienced one of the nicest falls, late yeah. summers and falls that I think we've had on record.
Incredible.
That was... Yeah? Nobody lives next to a river, man. We have the privilege of... In Africa, man, the river will move you. It'll come and move you. So it's just amazing. Like, you look out and the river's always there.
Well, that has happened here.
Yes.
Because there was this huge flood, yeah. I think, in 2007.
Yes, 2 years ago. Yeah. We had a huge, devastating flood right in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. So, Paula, what will you take back with you?
I will definitely take these beautiful images of fall and the leaves. But from the residency, I think, and from this experience in the U.S., I would say that my biggest discovery has been the Middle East.
The Middle East.
Yes.
Contact with writers such as
exactly.
Gada.
Yeah. Yeah. In Argentina, I have never met any person, of Islamic beliefs, and to me it was just wild to meet Gada, and to meet so many fantastic people, and just to really understand to what extent there is, you know, this horrible stereotype of a culture of certain people that, you know, I mean, not only on a personal level, because you can always, you know, meet people individually and say, you know, this person is great, but, you know, that doesn't apply to a whole religion or a whole nation. But then, I mean, you would really see how there is a fabrication, how there is a construction of a certain image that... that just fuels hatred and just fuels all the horrible things that, you know, just come to, I don't know, to sustain a horrible model that it's this economy through warfare, which is insane.
Do you, as a writer, picking up on perhaps a stereotype or cliche of Muslims in our world, in the Western world, as communicators, as writers, do you have any ideas about how to fight cliches, stereotypes that are destructive and build up walls rather than make a more tolerant society?
Well, I guess sometimes through Halloween.
Back to the Halloween costume.
But
Well, I mean, this is like my first residency. I've never been in one place with people from all over the world. So I think the one thing that I'm coming back with is lots of friends. Because, for example, I'm talking at, I have a talk at TED conference in the Netherlands next December. Stop for a minute. Said, who do I know in the Netherlands? Oh, I know Albana. And then Anya is near in Germany. I can visit Anya. And that was very, very...
So this is really, this residency has set up a network for you that will last years into the future.
Exactly.
And it's a global network.
And also it makes you feel that you have to treat people as individuals, not really as cultures or as stereotypes or as clichés. I mean, I've met a lot of people here from countries that I didn't quite like, but I adored the people.
You like
and,
the people.
and the other way around sometimes.
Got
I
it.
Really like the countries, but I don't like the people. But,
got it. Did you come here with some stereotypes, maybe about Americans that were busted, that were changed, some ideas about this culture that you saw weren't true?
Well, I was terrified from the airport experience. I mean, I thought about the airport, going through the airport like for many nights, and like I have a strategy, and I will be friendly, and I will be smiling because I don't need
any problem.
We want
to mention again, you wear a veil.
I wear a veil, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And people in the embassy, in the U.S. embassy back in Cairo, they told me like, if they want to search your bag, you open your bag. If they told you like, come here, you go there. And it's like, it was very scary, but actually the experience in the airport was great. I mean, I didn't meet any troubles. I didn't. No one really treat me without respect or anything. And coming here, I was a lot of my friends said like, you will love America. It's so different than Europe because I usually have some trouble in Europe. But they said, no, everyone is friendly and everyone is smiling and they like to be nice. Well, people were not so smiley in Iowa City, but in other cities they were. So I don't know. It was some kind of a roller coaster here. Sometimes I feel, you know, an incident like the rodeo, it will make me like feel scared. But
right.
Then people are nice again. But then they are not so nice. I don't know. It was really a roller coaster. But again, it teach me to, you know, treat people as individuals, not really as, you know, a bulk.
Before you took on this residency, did these four letters, IOWA, Iowa, mean anything to you, Paula?
Oh, well, yeah. I knew of a lot of writers that I admire from Argentina had come before. So to me, it was surrounded by some sort of veil of prestige and you know, I don't know, it's also some sort of mystery. I would imagine that there were like so many woods and that I would be living, you know, in the midst of the woods and that there would be absolutely no parties and that basically I would be like in a cave and people would just bring me a little food, which would be like the best situation for a writer. I mean, I was quoting Kafka. And well, that wasn't exactly the case.
And you will go there with a time machine? I mean, to live in a cave?
Oh, no, I would pay for a cave anytime.
Okay.
This has been also a kind of a nunnery for us, a certain kind of a monastery, which is also one of the reasons that I'm considering sporting an actual veil from now on. And, you know, as part of my conversion into Islam.
Actually, Iowa in Arabic means yes. So here's your first Arabic word. If someone ask you a question and you want to say in Arabic, it's Iowa.
And do you pronounce it? You pronounce it exactly the same.
Yeah, Iowa.
Iowa means yes in Arabic.
Yeah, see.
so that had only good connotations
for
you.
Yeah, of course.
It's good that it wasn't meaning no or something like that.
Yeah.
Billy, what's on your mind?
I mean, in the writing world, everyone knows about the University of Iowa, I assume. A lot of people know that. And just like Paula said, of course, it's a privilege. I mean, it's an honor being here because of the prestige like it just confers on anybody who's associated with it. So that definitely was the case. I expected huge fields of corn. I think Field of Dreams, the Kevin Costner movie.
You saw
Yeah, that's Iowa, right?
That is Iowa,
yeah,
indeed, yes.
That was one, I think, mental image.
In fact, you could have visited that very Field of Dreams actually, where it was filmed.
I don't know, I didn't think of this.
We didn't see any corn when we were here.
Stay a little.
It's harvested.
Yeah. Where have you been? You didn't?
Oh, I saw the corn.
I didn't.
You have to rent the film, Children of the Corn.
Yeah, but I even expected people to eat corn more here, but I didn't really find it.
Turns into a syrup.
Okay.
You're eating it all the time. Somehow.
We have a few minutes left with our writers, and I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit more about what you're working on now. You're writing generally, what you're working on now, and why you write about what you do. Can I start with you, Gada?
Well, I'm starting to write my second book, which is also talks about women's status in the Middle East, especially in Egypt. And the fact that a woman would live only for 9 months in Egypt, because before she gets married, she's only a girl, and after she gives birth, she's only a mother. So actually, we only live for 9 months as women. So, yeah, that's kind of the...
Is that changing with the younger generations? Are you a writer who is helping to change that? Do you want to change that?
I want to change that. It's not changing, but maybe when we talk about it, it will sort of change. So this will be my second book. Mm-hmm. And I'm also working on a couple of screen plays for movies. It's some kind of political comedy, and I'm still looking for a producer. But I'm really writing it right now.
Mm-hmm. So. Since you talked about women, there you only get to be a woman for 9 months in Egypt. Are there changes or perhaps misconceptions we have about women's roles vis-a-vis men here in the West and how that's changing?
Yeah. Well, back home it's like all the other countries of the world. Women always have the final word, and they are the head of the family, and they are the head of the household. Sometimes we play a game that, you know, we make the men believe that it's really their decisions, while it's not.
Why do we have the opposite impression here, many of us in the West?
Well, because you're not. I don't think that you're that keen to find out the truth. I mean, I was in a interview with NPR lately, and after they published the story on their website, there were a lot of comments saying, "Well, we don't want to find about that. We want to read about the oppression." So some people actually they don't want to find the truth. They just want to know what they always knew.
Is this to say that there are no Arab women, no Muslim women oppressed in cultures around the world?
Well, they are, but we're not all oppressed. I mean, and I'm, for example, I'm not oppressed, and I can't see myself on the American television screen or the American television talk shows or whatever. No one talks about me, and I don't know.
It's very one-sided is what you're saying.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Paula, tell us about your writing, what you're working on now.
Well, in the beginning, I was working in my second novel, which was, well, it dealt mostly with plants and naturalists. But then I began writing another novel, and which is kind of where I'm working now. And, well, also, well, I've been writing a few conferences. One of the fantastic things that I take from the IWP has been the opportunity of giving presentations and lectures in the United States. I've been in San Francisco State University. I have to go to the University of Florida, to Columbia University, and to Harvard University in November. And, well, also the lectures and the presentations here at the University of Iowa has been absolutely fantastic.
What is your goal in your writing? What do you want to communicate?
Printed things, mostly. And, I mostly deal with sort of a mixture between a literary style and a philosophical take in a way. So I just try to merge both. I was trained in philosophy, but I was trained in philosophy because I wanted to become a writer. I just thought it was the best way to gain precision in language and also some ability to deal with arguments. I wasn't very interested, you know, in following the fads and, you know, of like either romanticism or, you know, of just like grouping people by, you know, by styles or takes. I just wanted, you know, like the general feeling, which is the feeling that I get and the pleasure that is to me to read and to write.
To lose yourself in writing, you know, someone to sort of lose, get into someone else's world, into someone else's head.
Yeah, and also the role that ideas play, you know, within our mind and, you know, in this like neural network that it's the world, I just find that ideas are more and more becoming more and more relevant, and it's just as if, you know, certain particularist motives become, you know, transnational, and they can do so, you know, through ideas and through sensibility.
Billy, tell us about your goals as a writer.
I just like I think most writers, I'm trying to capture experience from my point of view or the points of view of my characters. Of course, this is not happening in isolation. This is happening with what are the narratives that have been written about. People talk about Africa as a whole. Mm-hmm. There are all these conversations and discourses about that. And first and foremost, I can only talk about Kenya, and even within Kenya, I can only talk about Nairobi, and within Nairobi, I can only talk about a certain place. So I'm very interested in mapping that, mapping experience in different ways.
And you want to change people's thinking in what way?
If just like I think most fiction does, I think apart from fighting that and the whole or everything that falls under whole post-colonial discourse, the other thing is fighting against what has happened in the new. What happens when a country gets independent and what kind of official texts are put into place? Because that's also a big thing. So what happens is that every narrative about Kenya is kind of politicized, whether it's the media, whether it's history. And things are false for because of political and economic interests. And I'm very, very interested in kind of countering that. And I hope my fellow writers, if you have 5-10 novels of different people saying things, this can be put together to actually give people a sense that this is a counter narrative that's also valid and needs to be looked at. And that's basically my project.
We have just a couple minutes left. Perhaps I can leave with this question and get your take on this. Very brief answers to this. How will your time, these 10 weeks, this work with 30-some writers from around the world, change your writing? Has it changed your path in any significant way? Paula.
Well, one of the things that I cherish the most from this experience has been the kindergarten kindred spirit of literature. You know, when you become a writer, then, you know, you start meeting other writers and, you know, you mostly, you know, writing the same language and, you know, it's not such a nice experience. And to me, it was fantastic to, you know, to rediscover the possibility of talking, you know, about literature without a war strategy, you know, on
sort it. Sort of a lack of pretense so that you can play with ideas and not feel pressure to.
Yeah, well, not only like not feel pressure, but, you know, I don't know, everybody's a little bit of a diva, you know, mostly when you come from, you know, from places that are kind of small and where literature is a very big deal in Argentina, because, you know, there is no possibility of having like a you know, kind of a national project. In a way, literature becomes a national project. So that is very interesting. It gains, you know, this stature of a public thing that it's just That it's unbelievable, and that, you know, that it's fantastic, you know, for writers, but at the same time, you know, it could be a little bit oppressive. So that's why I'm wearing a veil now.
Quick comment on that from others, very quickly.
Well, I really like the idea of that we could discuss and share without, you know, all the pressure. I mean, usually in literary communities, people are discussing with you, but they are only trying to prove you wrong. They don't try to give you their experience or talk, you know, openly about their writings. They are only trying to prove you wrong. So we didn't have that here, and that was cool.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll leave that as the last thought here. Glad there were no pressures there, and you could sort of play around with your work, bounce your ideas off of other people, and get feedback. Thank you very much this hour for your observations. Gada Abdul Al from Egypt, Billy Kuhora from Kenya, and Paula Aloy Chirac from Argentina. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us this hour. We hope you'll come back to Iowa at some point.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support also from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.